Welcome back to Shattering Mist. Before we turn our attention to Paul's letters and pick up where we had left off, Glenn has a comment about Kaepernick. Kaepernicking is a term that is used to describe Mr. Kaepernick when he is involved in good play and he kisses his bicep and flexes his muscles, and it's called Kaepernicking, which if I were a 49er fan, I would love, but since I'm not a 49er fan, I don't love it. But Glenn, I'm sure you're not calling to comment on Kaepernicking.
No. Just wanted to point out about the Lady Messiah thing.
Yes.
Calling herself Jesus. That could have been an issue. You know, if I had come upon that as a law enforcement official or an Ingram person, I would have been pulling some blood and checking for date rape drugs because she had been smoking something and then blacked out.
Yes.
So she had been split to Mickey and some a liquid and then become hypoxic from smoking, you know, maybe her, you know, we're tending to put all the onus on her. See, there could have been a date rape drug involved there.
Absolutely. No, that's why I was trying to say that, we can't accuse Kaepernick or the others that were there in his posse of, potentially doing that, because we don't know, my point really was there is no good explanation for what a naked woman claiming to be Jesus is doing in your hotel room bed, and they go from really bad, which is my if I were evaluating this, the first thing that I would think is that, well, this is a woman that we want to check for date rape drugs because this does not look good.
Right.
And then the second, and so that's, and that would be that it, then you got rape. The second is that if your need for sex is so great that you would bring a woman who is obviously unbalanced, who has got some kind of a disability, into your room for whatever entertainment purposes she may have been there. There's something seriously wrong with you. That's why I'm saying there are the justifications for being in that situation go from bad to horrible.
Right, exactly. There's no way to make it work.
There is no way to make that one work. If I were in law enforcement, I would have done exactly what you did, although I'm not sure that you always have that, that you can always do that. You may need the woman's consent, and she may have been so out of her mind that she wouldn't have given her consent.
Well, then if she's here in Pennsylvania, they call it 302. If someone's out of it, then they can be, you know, voluntarily confined against their will for 72-hour period of observation.
Oh, okay. All right. This probably would have qualified for that. I won't leave the hotel room. Naked in the bed, claiming to be Jesus. That might have, you know, if that doesn't qualify, I don't know what does. But again, this was in Florida. I don't know what, you know, if, you know, Florida does have the stand your ground law, and maybe that's what she thought she was doing.
The interesting thing about the 72 hours is, you know, it gives time for medical testing, letting it wear off, you know, counseling the family, et cetera, and then damage control, you know, and blah, blah, blah. Alrighty, that's all, you know, I wanted to add, you know, instead of, allowing all of the onus to be on her, because we don't know, you know, like you said, we don't know.
I'm glad you called, because that was not my intent. That wasn't our intent. Intent is just to say that there are no good ways out of this situation, and whether the woman was insane and or mentally handicapped or drugged or drunk, there's still there's no good excuses here for anybody.
It always seems to me that naked chicken gets vilified. You know, it's just
don't leave a naked chicken in your hotel bedroom. This delusion.
Look what they did. Look what happened to Chawla. You know.
Yeah. That's pretty sad.
And then they had to do the vegetation thing, and then, I had to make them, give them skins for clothing. Anyway. Yeah. All right, I'm done being annoying.
Okay.
I'll sit on the side and listen. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you. It's hard to make the transition between the naked woman in the bed and Chawa, the actual name for Eve in the garden being naked. But, Glenn, you managed to do it. All right. Yosha told us how we are to deal with temptation. And that temptation could be directly from Satan, as it was in his case, or it could be the temptation to participate in a religion. It could be the temptation to be engaged in something that is in conflict with Yahweh. It might just be the decision as to whether or not I should accept what somebody is saying as true or not. And so here is Yosha. He's out in the wilderness. This is from Matanyah 4:4. This is before he has begun his ministry. This is immediately before his public declaration, which is called the Sermon on the Mount, which is his teaching on the Mount. And it reads as follows. But then the one having become the answer. This is a very interesting word. It's apokrinomai. It means that this is the one who helps us separate fact from fiction, the one who helps us distinguish from the truth from deceit. Now, he did not speak Greek here, so we can't make too big a deal of the Greek. It's a translation of the discussion, which was in Hebrew. But nonetheless, apo means to separate, and krino means to separate again. So, when you read the passage in English, judge not lest you be judged. Judged is from krino, and krino actually means separate. So the actual passage is, don't separate or you will be separated. It goes from being contradictory to the discussion that it is used in, where Yosha is being judgmental of the advocates of religion and politics, to making sense, which is that religion and politics separate men and women from God. And if you deploy religion or politics to separate souls from God, then you will be separated from God. So it goes from being in conflict with what's in the discussion to being consistent with it when you translate krino appropriately. Apokrino would be, apo means to separate, and krino means to separate, and so you've got separation upon separation. And the inference here is that Yosha can be used as a means to make this kind of separation. He told us that he did not come to bring peace, but it's instead division. And he even went on to say that, that what people decide relative to him will divide families. And it's true. The whole concept of cutting the covenant and of us choosing by our own volition to be either cut into the covenant or cut out of the covenant speaks of this. But it also speaks to the process of determining what is of God and what is not of God. And if you want to know what is of God versus what's not of God, and you want to be able to separate the two, that which is reliable from that which is not, which is the whole purpose of reviewing Paul's letters, is to determine whether or not they should be separated from that which is God, or included from what is of God, then this combination of apo and krino is an interesting term. Going back to the beginning, but then the one, having become the answer, having provided the means to separate fact from fiction, said, "It has been written, not upon bread alone, by itself, without help from monos, will this man assuredly live, but upon every spoken statement departing through the mouth of Yahweh." Now, it is interesting that the term for bread, artos, is a baked loaf of bread with yeast, which aerates. The food in general speaks of aerated food. It is, artos is from aero. Aero is the Greek word that we transliterate to the English word air, and it means to rise up from the ground. And so this bread, the Greek term, is specifically yeasted bread. And so Yosha is telling us, no, I can't consume the yeast, which he defines as political and religious corruption. If I did that, if I'm consuming the yeast, then I'm corrupting myself. And no, I'm not going to do that. I mean, the whole purpose is for me to be matzah, for me to be unyeasted bread, so that I can fulfill the promise of matzah. And rather than explain the logic of it, which would have been a perfectly appropriate thing for Yahusha to do, just as I have done for you here, Yahusha took a different tactic. And the tactic he took is one that we should take, which is that he said that not upon bread alone, by itself, without help, would this man surely live, but upon every spoken statement departing out of the mouth of Yahweh. What he did is he actually cited the Torah. And so he went beyond simply giving the rationale for his decision. He said that he's saying that God's answers are the answers that matter. Now, while God's answer happened to be consistent with the rationale that I've shared with you, the only irrefutable source is Yahweh's testimony. And that's why Yosha's cited. And that's why it's so troubling when we have discussions with the advocates of either Hebrew roots or Christianity. And they, when confronted with Yahweh's testimony, when we do what Yosha did here, which is to quote the Torah to explain why the religious position is inappropriate, that rather than say, wow, that is the irrefutable, always dependable source of evidence, I stand corrected, almost always they did what Satan even wouldn't do, which is to question the resource, to discard Yah's testimony. Yes, you see, when we studied this testimony, we found that Yosha became the answer by quoting the Torah. If you want the antidote for being misled, if you want to discern that which is true from that which isn't false, cite the Torah. It is the answer every time. It's why when people say, you know, I received a letter today, someone saying, you know, what do you think about the book of Enoch? And anytime I see that, I say, oh boy, there's somebody that has been misled into thinking there's different times to celebrate the invitations to meet with Yahweh because of the different calendar that's presented in Enoch. And my answer is always the same. Yahweh gives us a very succinct means to determine what he has inspired and what he hasn't. He says that what I have inspired will include prophecy, and the prophecy will be always accurate. What I inspired will be wholly consistent with my testimony. And if you find an inconsistency with my testimony, then it's not for me. You can apply the test. It's presented in Devarim 13 and the 18th chapter. And Enoch fails that test. And all you have to do is look at the fact that Enoch was put together in the 2nd century BCE, long after the last of the prophetic books were revealed, and that it is a fraud. It's not attributable to Enoch. Enoch, the individual Enoch, didn't write a book, and we have nothing from him. And so it's a deliberate fraud. And all you have to do is apply the test, and you'll know that that is the case. Well, that's what Yosha did. And he did it constantly. He was constantly citing the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Right now I'm doing a review of Daniel 7, 8, and 9. And what you find is that virtually all of it makes its way into the later chapters of Revelation, all the way from Revelation 12 through Revelation 19 is an explanation of Daniel 7, 8, and 9. About the nature of the beast, and it's very much like at the end of chapter 8 of Daniel, when the vision to Daniel is explained by the angel, the Malach, the messenger named Gabriel, which means mighty one of Yah. That he takes the time and said, listen, I want to make sure that you understand what you've just seen. And he explains that each of these explain exactly which country each of these represent and how they will materialize and play out in our future with the Torahless one of the tribulation. And so in Revelation, is Yahusha is quoting, providing his testimony to Yahochanan. He's doing this very same thing. He says, you know, I want you to make sure that you understand this, because understanding the role of Babylon and Rome in the worlds today, both past and present as well as future, is essential for us understanding God's animosity towards religion and politics. And he's still asking us to come out of Babylon, a nation that, you know, had been destroyed for 600 years prior to his revelation to Yahochanan, which means it's not the Babylon, the country. It's what Babylon represents. But all of what he said was an explanation of what Yahweh had already revealed. It is always the answer. You want to know what's going to happen? Read the Torah. Read the prophets. You want to know what has happened? Read the Torah. Read the prophets. If you want the answer, no matter what the question is, if the question has to do with your relationship with God or your salvation, the means to either of those two things, no matter what somebody says, the answer is always found in the Torah. This is goes on to say, this happens to be the passage that Yosha was citing in this case. It says, and you benefited from his response. This is Moshe speaking with the children of Yisrael in the wilderness. So it's explaining why Yosha chose that reference. And it says, and you benefited from his response. Wa'ana. He answered you in such a way that you could choose to benefit based upon what he was offering, which is why he wanted you to be hungry. He wants you to be hungry, because if you're hungry, then you're going to respond to what he's offering, is the message here. And so he could feed you with the manna, which you did not understand. We'll be back. We'll consider more in a moment. When you consider the passage from the Torah that Yahusha cited to explain why he didn't want to consume the aerated bread, which means it was bread that was baked with yeast, why he didn't want to consume the yeast, which he defines as religious and political poison, the very thing that he came to remove from us, he didn't want to ingest himself. He quoted a Torah passage. And it's a Torah passage where Moshe is explaining what God offered on behalf of the children of Israel while they were walking through the wilderness. And he's specifically talking about how the children of Israel said they were getting hungry, and God was pleased by that because it gave him the opportunity to feed them. And the reason that that story is important is not just because that is the role of a father to provide nourishment for his children. But because it also explains God's instructions regarding what is good and not good for us to eat. The very word that he chose for the manna is, you ain't got a clue what this is. that's basically what manna means. That you ain't got a clue as to what this is. And you'd say, well, why would he choose such an odd term? And why would he then conclude this statement that I'm glad you were hungry because I could feed you, which, of course, shows the fatherly instinct, is because he says that what you ought to be consuming if you want to live, feeding upon is every word that comes out of Yahweh's mouth, which you'll find in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, full stop. Now, the reason that strikes me as being so vitally important is that, the religious types want you to believe that the Torah is comprised of laws and that there are food laws, for example, and that you ought to obey the food laws, which means if you want a little pepperoni in your pizza, you are really out of luck. You want to have a little sea roach tonight, a little lobster? No way. You want a shrimp cocktail? Oh, my God, you are going to go into the penalty box. You cannot be saved. That's not God's intent at all. By concluding that the matzah, which they didn't have a clue what it was represented the word of Yahweh, and that we ought to be consuming the word of Yahweh, God is using his discussion on what is good for us to eat and what's not good for us to eat to convey an important message. And the important message is if you consume that which is not from God, you're going to get sick. And if you consume that which is from God, you're going to be healthy and you're going to live. And so in the food laws, what God distinguishes, not laws, but the food teaching on what's good and not good to eat, you'll notice that almost everything on the this is not healthy for you is something that either eats garbage, feeds on dead flesh, or doesn't have the proper mechanism for digesting food. What it eats such that it's healthy for us. Or it's a creature that is prone to debilitating diseases, or the carrier of debilitating diseases, as is the case of the swine. In fact, swine not only eat garbage, but the way they process their food, they're particularly prone to carrying things that are harmful for us. And so God said, if you eat that kind of garbage, if you consume it, then he's going to make you sick. Shrimp and lobsters, for example, seafood without gills, they're bottom feeders. And as a bottom feeder, they consume the rubbish, the trash of the ocean. Vultures, for example, they feed off of the dead flesh. This guy says, don't eat that. That's not good for you. And the things that are good for you is that which I have shared. Feast off my words if you want to live. It's one of a million ways that God underscores the purpose of his Torah teaching, which is to nourish our minds, to nourish our bodies, to help us grow and be healthy, be restored to life. So here's this statement. And you benefited from his response, wa'ana, which is you expressed your hunger and then you benefited from the fact that God responded. You benefited from his response, which is why he wanted you to be hungry. Not that he enjoyed them having hunger pains, but when they were hungry, then God could provide for them, which is what he wishes to do for us. And so he could feed you with the manna. Manna is from man. It's a nourishing and sweet-tasting nectar from God, considered to be the bread of life. It's from the Hebrew word ma, which is an interrogative asking, what is this? What does it mean? Ma is an interrogative. So it's the very manna, and the word that it was made up of is, what in the world is this? What does it mean? Because if we question, what does it mean when God is feeding us, when God is saying, here's things that are good for you to eat, things that are not good for you to eat, what does it mean? What should we be aware of? What should we question? What is this? Then that's God's way of responding to us so that we can feed on what he has provided, which is his testimony. So, and he could feed you with the manna, which you did not know. Yo, lo, yada, you did not actually understand. You were unaware of what it represents. And also your fathers would have not known. In order to help you know and understand that indeed, it's not upon bread alone shall man continually live and be restored to life, but instead, indeed, rather, upon everything that flows out of the mouth of Yahweh shall man continually live and actually be restored to life. The purpose of every instruction that is in the Torah isn't to be a law to be obeyed. It is a teaching to be understood. It is guidance that helps us know. And when we view God's word as the most nourishing thing for our souls that helps us continually live and be restored to life, then we're in a position to capitalize on everything that he said. When you go to swine isn't good for you to eat, full stop, don't go any further, then you gain nothing. You don't know why it's there. You know, your diet may not have any baby back ribs in it or pepperoni sausage. But how is that going to help you understand who God is and what he's offering if you don't want to go beyond do this, don't do that? Now, the Torah was teaching presented to us by our Father to guide our steps so that we could come to know and understand, and that we come to realize that what he has shared with us is nourishing. And what man has shared with us, by contrast, can be poisonous. So the phrase, the statement that's found in the Torah that Yahusha cited to explain why he wasn't going to eat the yeasted bread was brilliant. It pointed us to a truth that if Christians would say, you know, I think I'm going to follow his example. I want to follow his example. Then they too would turn to the Torah and look for the nourishing words of God there. But of course, the founder of the Christian religion says, no, discard that. He even says the Torah can't provide life. And yet here's God himself saying that the words that flow out of his mouth, of Yahweh's mouth, shall cause man to continually live and be restored to life. The citation was from Devarim 8:3. Now, unlike Paul, Yahusha not only cited the complete statement from the Torah. He didn't take a truncated portion. He said, this is the, and he gave him the whole thing. And he pulled it from a discussion which was perfectly suited to affirm God's guidance to answer the specific question being posed. He chose the right verse, and he quoted it entirely, and he quoted it accurately, and the passage actually affirmed the point that Yahusha was making. Paul did exactly the opposite. He made the correlation between life and God's testimony, the very path through life he himself represents. Since this is important, literally, the means to life and death, and since the contrast between Yahusha and Shaul, Paul, is so considerable, let's examine Devarim words 8:3 in context. Moshe, the man Yahweh invited to scribe his Torah, the book Shaul has sought to demean and discount, was reminiscing about what they had heard, what they had observed, what they had learned and experienced together over the past 40 years. It was important that they recognize that, you know, we ought to reflect on this. We've been able to spend this time freed of the religious and political oppression of Egypt and to spend time with our Creator, who is taking care of us as a loving father. Let's reflect on this. And it begins. All of the terms and conditions, the mitzvah, the codicils of the covenant, which beneficially I have instructed, shawa, provided by way of directions and guidance this day, for you to genuinely choose and to continuously observe, shamar, for you to want to closely examine and always carefully consider, electing to consistently and literally focus upon. Now, shamar here was written in the call stem, which is, encourages us to see the relationship between these ideas and for us to interpret what's being conveyed to us literally. That I want you to literally observe. To literally observe, there's only one way you can do that when you're talking about words. And that is to read them with your eyes. That is what observe means in a literal application of the term. Read what has been written. We'll be back in a moment. So Moshe is encouraging the children of Yisrael, which means individuals who engage and endure with God, to reflect on what Yahweh has told them. You know, this is an extremely important concept, folks. If you simply read what God has to say, but you don't bother to reflect on it, it's not going to do you a whole lot of good. If you simply listen to what God has to say, but don't bother to make the connections to try to understand, if you don't invest the energy for understanding, not going to do much good. Now, I tell you, it's better to read what he has to say and to listen to what he has to say than to take the Pauline Christian view and to discard it, to discount it. But still, it's about reflecting upon it, about considering it, that justifies the use of our faculties to observe. But here, as we begin this first part of this revelation, we come up to Shamar, and we come to realize that it was written in the call stem, which requires a literal interpretation. And there's only one way to literally observe a written text, and that is to read it. And it was written in the paragogic non-ending, which is a volitional mood. And so God is not commanding us to read it, but encouraging us to read it. He wants us to want to read it. That's the reason why when you're dealing with terms like the second term here, the first is kol, all of, and then mitzvah is the second. Mitzvah is almost always translated commands or commandments. But if it's a commandment, then our free will is irrelevant. You know, if you give a military officer a command, then volition is irrelevant. They have to follow the order. You would never combine volition, the paragogic non-ending, with a command. And so one of the challenges of translating from Hebrew into English is to make certain that your definitions of words, your translations, are consistent with the text. And because this happens to be Yahweh, consistent with Yahweh's nature. Here is Yahweh feeding his children. Here is this context, which is, I have instructed, I have provided instruction, I provided guidance. The fourth word here is the Hebrew word shawa, T-S-A-W-A-H. And that is guidance, it's direction, it's teaching. And so you'd say, all right, I've got this word mitzvah that the lexicons tell me I ought to translate command, but a command is not a teaching, a command is an order. And so you can't translate it command and use it in the process of an instruction, of a direction, of guidance. And so challenge them to look up the word and look up its roots and look up related words and to filter out those which are consistent with Yahweh's nature and consistent with the context and filter out those that are inconsistent. Recognizing those that are inconsistent have been layered on by religious advocates. So all of the terms and conditions, mitzvah, and when you say a term and a condition, a condition is for participation in a relationship. A term is a term of an agreement. So if you have an agreement, it'll have terms. If you have a relational document, a relationship document, it's going to have conditions for you, for the various parties. And truly, the covenant is a relationship agreement with terms and conditions. And so if you're thinking you're going to relate mitzvah, terms and conditions, to the codicils of the covenant. So all of the terms and conditions, the codicils of the covenant, which beneficially, this next word is Asher. And you know, we're going through some real detail here, and this may be tough on a radio program to wrap your mind around this, but the reason it's important is this is the very testimony of God. This is the nourishment that God wants us to feed upon. And so it's really important that we convey it as accurately, as completely as possible. Asher is a very important word. It's used thousands of times in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Asher has a definition and it has a function. The definition of Asher is that which is beneficial, that which is fortuitous. And its function is to make a connection between things, to develop a relationship. And so in our program tomorrow, hopefully as early as the second hour, we will consider this testimony, analyzing each of the words so that we glean as much truth as absolutely possible and are completely nourished by the testimony of Yahweh.